The City Club of Boise is a nonpartisan forum dedicated to free speech and the open exchange of ideas on issues critical to the Intermountain Northwest. Its motto is, "Things happen when people start talking." You can find information regarding forums, salons, and tours at cityclubofboise.org. Annual sponsors for the City Club are Northwest Nazarene University, Red Sky, and the Idaho Humanities Council. The moderator for today's forum is Greg Hahn.
Well, hello and welcome to today's City Club of Boise Forum featuring public health leader Dr. Christine Hahn. Dr. Hahn has served as Idaho State Epidemiologist since 1998, and she serves as the Medical Director in the Division of Public Health in the Idaho Department of Health and Welfare. I'm Greg Hahn, no relation, I should point out. I'm a board member at the City Club and today's moderator. I want to welcome our radio listeners today. They join us on Boise State Public Radio on KBSX 91.5 and its affiliates throughout southern Idaho and northern Nevada. Today's forum sponsors are the Echelon Group and Perkins Coie. I recently spent a few days on vacation in London, and after we hit the high points of Kensington Palace, the Tower of London, and Westminster Abbey, my wife insisted on dragging us all over the streets of Soho looking for a particular corner off Broad Street. It turns out, as I presume some of you already know, that this particular city street corner and this water pump that once stood there was ground zero for a cholera epidemic in 1854 and one of the quintessential formative moments in what we now know as public health. Unlike his modern Game of Thrones character namesake, this doctor, Jon Snow, he did know something. He thought the cholera appeared to him to be spread through the water. Nobody believed him, so he set out to prove it, and I think his devotion to applying scientific methods to solving a public health problem, and then to use those to educate his peers and fellow citizens, have remained to some degree at the core of what public health is all about today. From its foundations of fighting infectious diseases, from yellow fever and malaria to cholera and typhoid fever to the modern charge of battling chronic and fatal conditions like cancer, heart disease, and the kinds of health conditions that stem from workplace or the environment around us, public health leaders, investigators, doctors, and communicators have played an essential role in what we sometimes take for granted as our modern human health. But it doesn't take too many weeks of reading the headlines to know that conditions like whooping cough and influenza still plague Idaho at times, and scary-sounding new infectious diseases like Ebola, West Nile, and Zika always lurk in the shadows. Dr. Christine Hahn has been on the front lines of these health battles for many years, and she brings a unique perspective on how the fight has changed and where it might be going next. After attending medical school at Michigan State University, she completed a residency in internal medicine at arguably the most prestigious facility in the world, which I say because I have two grandfathers who worked there, the Mayo Clinic's Graduate School of Medicine, and a fellowship in infectious diseases at Duke University Medical Center. She went on to train for a couple of years as an epidemic intelligence service officer with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, which to me sounds both mysterious and cool. She became the Idaho State epidemiologist and now serves as the state's tuberculosis controller and the medical director for the Division of Public Health. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Christine Hahn.
Thank you, Greg, and I'm very sorry you had to introduce me because all those you had a lot of words there that I know people don't say every day. Epidemiologist took me a while to master. All right. So first of all, I want to thank you all for coming here today. And as Greg alluded to, the world of public health, I think we often feel like we work in the shadows a little bit. And that's okay. We don't need the recognition. But it is nice for people to know what we do, because I think when a society knows what people do, they value it, and then they invest in it. So first, I want to thank, again, the director of the Department of Health and Welfare has come here. And we've had the deputy director here as well, and the Division of Public Health director. Thank you guys for showing up, and I really appreciate the support from my own agency. We also have folks here from Central District Health Department. One thing I'll talk about is that public health really is ultimately a local engagement. I'll refer a little bit to a movie that some of you may have seen called Contagion, where Kate Winslet very winningly went and solved the pandemic flu outbreak. But that's not how public health works, and those of us that work in public health, including those at CDC, acknowledge and recognize that these outbreaks are solved at the local level with the support from the state and the federal partners. So thank you for being here, and as has already been acknowledged, I'm very happy to see so many partners from Boise State here as well. So how did I end up in public health? My background is in medicine, as Greg alluded to, and I first went to a university, Michigan State, that really trains family physicians, and I thought I was going into family medicine, fell in love with infectious diseases, and a lot of the words that partly maybe because they were so hard to say, but they're so fascinating, leptospirosis, echinococcus, pertussis, you know, those kind of vaguely glamorous diseases kind of attracted me compellingly, and I found myself interested in infectious disease. At Duke University, I found that it was in the middle of the AIDS epidemic, and it was very, very difficult time to be working in AIDS. It was the mid-1990s, and we had not yet developed the excellent treatments that are available today, the life-saving treatments, and people were very sick. And I found myself picturing a career where I was mostly in the hospital with very sick people. I had three mentors at Duke, and they were all people I admire, the head of infectious diseases, the head of the laboratory, and a great teacher there. They all three had done the Epidemic Intelligence Service at CDC, and they said, you seem like that type of person where you should consider the Epidemic Intelligence Service, which, of course, I had never heard of either. And I looked into it, and it was a two-year commitment, and I thought, what the heck? That'll give me some time to figure out which direction I want to go. And never looked back. Fell in love with public health and found that, indeed, taking care of patients, which I only do for tuberculosis now anymore, taking care of patients is a wonderful, wonderful career, but that I was cut out more for public health and some of the things that we do, which I'll talk about. So I wanted to frame my remarks around some things I've learned through my years of working in public health, and I'm calling it 10 things I've learned in public health, of course, there are many more that we won't have time for. First of all, we work on things that most people don't think are a problem anymore. When I tell people I work in the TB clinic, they're like, I usually get a quizzical look. TB clinic, but do we have TB in Idaho is a very common response. And I go on and explain that, well, not a lot, but yes, indeed, there are, first of all, a third of the world's population is infected with TB. I mean, that's astonishing if you think about it, a third of the world. Now, many of them will never activate. It's a bacteria that can stay in the body. We call it sleeping when we're talking to patients because that's a way of explaining the germ can be controlled by your immune system. But you get cancer, you get older, you get HIV, and that germ can wake up and cause sickness. Or sometimes even for no reason, even in healthy people, sometimes TB wakes up. In the United States, about 4% of our population is infected with TB. So we have a much lower burden, but it's still here. My own mother has a positive skin test for TB. She's from Germany. She grew up during World War II. She lived in a refugee camp. With all the discussion about refugees these days, I like to think about the fact that my mother was a refugee, and this country welcomed her with open arms, and I'm very grateful to the United States for that. But I digress. So TB, TB plague, some of you recall just this last summer we put out lots of alerts. The district health department did a great job around. We had several district health departments doing a great job informing the public about the risk of plague in our state. We have ground squirrels that have plague. It'll probably always be with us. We had several pet cats, develop plague this year, but no people. And that's the success of public health. We feel that by informing people about the risks, reminding them how to avoid those flea bites or avoiding the cat bites that might get you infected, we protect the public. Typhoid fever, that's one of our favorites. It's another classic public. Anybody who's trained in public health has heard not only about that pump handle in London that Jon Snow took off to stop the cholera outbreak, they've also heard about Typhoid Mary. And Typhoid Mary is someone that I use to illustrate another point. And that is that many of the powers of public health, that state and local health, are the ones that implement them. So Typhoid Mary was a cook you may be aware of, and that, of course, wasn't her legal name. Her legal name was Mary Mallon, and she was a cook. And the New York City Department of Health spent decades battling Typhoid Mary. She was implicated in several typhoid fever outbreaks in families and households where she'd go work as a cook, and as soon as they would try to go figure out what was going on, she would move on to another job. Twice she was isolated and put into a quarantine on an island in the New York Harbor where she could not, and eventually they would let her out and then she'd go go back to work as a cook again because she made better money. And she did not understand or believe that since she felt perfectly fine, how on earth could she be making people sick? And that's a challenge I think we all still face today, right? It's very hard to convince somebody that I know you don't feel sick, but you could potentially be carrying something or could potentially spread it to other people. And so that is indeed not hard to believe why an Irish cook who is just, you know, a fresh new immigrant, hadn't had a formal education, how hard that would be to explain to somebody. Nonetheless, it was the local health department that had to really do the battle, if you will, to try to keep the public safe. It is thought today that she probably infected 51 people, made 51 people sick with typhoid fever, and three of them died. So it was a serious, serious problem. But the battles that resulted from that situation, we live again today, which is that constant struggle in public health between the freedom of the individual and the safety of the public. We have to constantly balance that, and typhoid Mary embodies that very, very well. But there are other things that we do besides infectious diseases. We also have great programs in public health, as Greg alluded to in the beginning, that have nothing to do with infectious disease. We have Women's Health Check that provides breast and cervical cancer screening to low-income women. We have a refugee health screening program. We work with the Family Medicine Residency of Idaho to ensure that all refugees coming in are quickly screened for infectious diseases, are given needed immunizations, et cetera. We also track births, deaths, et cetera, through our vital stats program and release health statistics to the public so they can see what are Idahoans dying of, what are the problems, health problems that we face. We have the Idaho State Emergency Medical Systems Communication Center that functions 24/7, is an emergency dispatch for the Idaho Transportation Department for 16 emergency medical systems agencies throughout the state. It issues the amber alerts that you hear every once in a while and also helps respond to hazardous materials incidents that I'll be talking about a little bit later. We have a great state public health lab. They can test, and you'll hear about this with the anthrax scare. They were instrumental in testing all those white powders out there. They tested a lot of white powder. And they also are our TB lab for the state, and they do many other things supporting the local public health districts and outbreak investigations. We have a food protection program that also works very closely with the district health departments to keep our restaurants and food supply safe. So I've already alluded to my number two lesson learned, which was that the power of public health is really state and local, not so much the federal. And one way that you might see that happen, it's rare, is isolation and quarantine. We still do have those authorities. It's very rare that we use them. The most common have been cases of TB, but that's not the only way they are used. And I remember talking to my dad, who grew up in southern Ohio, and he remembered when somebody had measles, they'd slap a sign on the door, you know, quarantine, keep out kind of thing. And you don't see that anymore. And we work very, very hard to protect the privacy and the rights of the people who are potentially ill with diseases. But we still have those authorities. Number three, our relationship to animals is a continuous pathway for new diseases. As my husband knows, who's here, we have dogs, cats, a rabbit, and chickens. So I feel like I'm a good example of how modern society, even though most of us don't live on farms anymore, we are still very close to animals. And we have them for pets, we have them for food, we like to hunt them. I'm looking at Russ Duke here, who is an avid hunter. That is a pathway that continues to be something we need to be aware of, whether it's E. coli in hamburgers originating in cows, swine or bird flu, salmonella from reptiles, including small turtles, which, as you may know now, small turtles have been restricted by the FDA because they had so many salmonella outbreaks from them. And then more ones that don't make the news. I was just reading this week, there's a virus called the Soul virus, S-E-O-U-L, Soul virus, that has been linked to pet rats. And that's being investigated right now in Wisconsin and Illinois with CDC's help. That hasn't made the national news yet, but if someone dies or gets very sick from that, which is a possibility, this Soul virus is related to hantavirus, so there's the potential for severe illness. If that happens, you might be reading about that in your paper in the next few days. So this work continues, and our relationship with animals continues. The sole virus outbreak in Wisconsin, Illinois reminds me and may remind some of you of the monkeypox outbreak that happened in 2003 in this country. And that was related to rats, giant Gambian pouched rats. They're very cute. They have huge pouchy cheeks. And they were being imported as pets from West Africa, which turned out was not such a good idea. They carried monkeypox, and several people got quite ill from that. Number four, people are more afraid of new or unknown threats than of old threats, and that is just human nature. I've given up trying to argue about that. I understand that's human nature, because anything we don't know very much about, we're more afraid of. So anything that killed, let's say, thousands of people every year, you think we'd be very afraid of. And of course, for those of you in public health, know I might be referring to the flu. So the flu kills thousands of Americans every year. We're about to update our webpage to show we've had 18 deaths reported in Idaho this season so far. We know that there are more that we've got unofficially reported. We know we're already in the 20s. And yet, in Idaho, only 39% of people bother to get a flu shot, because flu, it's a threat we're used to. If we had Ebola come in and kill that many people, I think there'd be a mass panic, right? Because we would be very, very afraid of that. But flu, and because flu, we've heard about flu since we were little kids. We've maybe even had it. We've done okay. We forget what a terrible, terrible disease it can be. One of our deaths is in a young adult. We think sometimes, I might get sick, but it's just the older folks that die from it. One is in a young adult, and I just became aware today of a child that is hospitalized with flu right now, that they're not sure how well that person's going to do, and we won't release anything more until we know more. But it is the more I know about flu, the more I respect it as a terrible disease, and I do drag my children every year to get their flu shots, even though they were very disappointed not to be able to get the nasal spray this year, which they used to get. So hopefully that'll be back soon. The other number five I want to mention is that hand washing works. Kind of going through flu shots and hand washing and all those things that you think, oh my gosh, there's public health for you. But hand washing is one of those things. It's very hard to teach your kids to do. I feel like we try very, very hard, and we still have to. Either my husband or myself, we didn't hear the water running. You know, we're still having to make those calls with our kids. But it has been shown in studies in Bangladesh, in Karachi, in other very, very poor, impoverished areas with very, very limited access to soap or running water, that if you just have people wash their hands with water alone, it reduces diarrheal illness by 50%. Just water. You add soap to that, and you just add a factor of protection. Respiratory disease as well. During flu season, we're always reminding people to wash your hand. It has also been shown to reduce respiratory diseases. But how does soap work? Does it kill bacteria? Does it kill anything? No, what it does is it removes it from your hands. It washes it down the drain, which is why you may be aware the FDA in September just removed those antibacterial things from consumer products. Because all those antibacterial dishwashing detergents and hand washes and all that weren't doing a thing, and there's some concern that they may have health impact. So they've been removed. There's a year, the manufacturers have a year to get them out of the product, so you might still see some on the shelf. But triclosan, which you may be familiar with, that was the most common one, that is no longer allowed. Now, in a hospital setting, that's a different matter, but in the community setting, It has never been recommended by public health, I'm happy to say. We have always said soap and water is what you need, and we always felt a little bit backwards until now. So it is important to remember that it's the water and it's the soap. It's getting that bacteria and viruses off your hands that's important. It's not killing them that's important. Number six, vaccines will always be controversial. I have given up thinking that at some point it'll just be easy. And again, I understand people are saying, I feel perfectly fine. Why should I subject myself or my kids to any risk whatsoever? I feel fine. We're healthy. I haven't seen a polio outbreak in my neighborhood lately. I understand that. But because we believe it is so important, we will continue to have this conversation. A quick history there. Smallpox was the first vaccine. the first modern vaccine. And initially, people had discovered, without medical people getting involved, people had figured out on their own in parts of Africa, in parts of the Middle East, in India, that if you took somebody with smallpox, and they would usually take somebody with a milder case, they would take their lesions and actually rub them into the skins of somebody else, make a cut and rub it in, that you actually could protect that person from severe disease. That is an incredibly risky thing to do. And in fact, about 2% of the time when that was done, that person got a severe case of smallpox and died. Could you imagine accepting a risk like that nowadays? I'd like to give you this shot, and it's about 2% chance you'll die from it. I mean, it's unheard of. But people were so afraid of smallpox, they would do it. Why is that? Well, smallpox has about a 30% mortality. And in fact, in some outbreaks, about half of people with smallpox died. So imagine that kind of fear when it's so contagious. People didn't quite understand how it was spreading. They thought it might be the bad air, right, or the water. They didn't understand how it was spreading. They just knew that if you got it, your child died, got it, maybe half of them will die. So people were willing to take that risk. Edward Jenner is credited with the discovery of the cowpox. This was the, I always like to remind people, that's why we say pretty as a milkmaid to this day, right? Milkmaids were known to not get the disfiguring scars of smallpox because they'd all had cowpox. And it was common knowledge in the people. Again, it's not the medical great discovery. It was the people that figured this out. And a milkmaid made a comment to Edward Jenner, like, oh, yeah, I'm not worried about smallpox because I've got the cowpox. And he said, well, I wonder if you purposely tried to give people cowpox, if that would be a protective measure. It was a huge leap. It was incredibly successful. Was he lauded by the medical community? No, of course not. He was scoffed and disregarded for about 50 years. As this is the way progress works, right? But eventually his ideas became accepted. And this practice of vaccination, and vaccine still refers to the Latin word vacca for cow. So the word vaccine actually even derives from this finding by Edward Jenner, that vaccination was much safer than variolation, which was that old way of just taking somebody with smallpox. So cowpox replaced smallpox. But it was, again, a difficult, it's a whole separate story about how it came in the United States. There was a lot of controversy. And I just want to read one quote by Benjamin Franklin. In 1736, I lost one of my sons, a fine boy of 4 years old, by the smallpox, taken in the common way. I long regretted bitterly and still regret that I had not given it to him by inoculation. This I mention for the sake of parents who omit that operation on the supposition that they shall never forgive themselves if a child died under it, my example showing that the regret may be the same either way and that, therefore, the safer should be chosen. And then he later wrote, notwithstanding the now uncontroverted success of inoculation, it does not seem to make that progress among the common people in America which was at first expected. Scruples of conscience weigh with many concerning the lawfulness of the practice, and if one parent or near relation is against it, the other does not choose to inoculate a child without free consent of all parties, lest in case of a disastrous event, perpetual blame should follow. And I think these are amazing words to think today. I think of parents that aren't vaccinating their kids. I think one thing that we remind ourselves is they believe they are doing the best thing for their child. I know that they do. And it is, but what we need to continue to counter them with is information that we believe the best choice, the right choice, is to vaccinate. And just this last week, the director and I were able to speak to our legislature, the health and welfare committees, on this topic, and talk about how we try to implement vaccination in Idaho and yet leave choice up to parents to exempt for medical, religious, or personal reasons, which is not the standard in many, many states. Only medical exemptions are allowed, or some states only medical or religious. So it is a discussion that is ongoing. And I just want to mention HPV vaccine, not to shy away from any controversy. So this is the one this is the one that is, in my mind, a cancer-preventing vaccine. I was so excited to get my 12-year-old daughter down there and get her vaccinated. I'm like, I cannot believe I can protect her from a type of cancer. And yet, the uptake has been slow. I could almost read Benjamin Franklin's statement again. Uptake has been slow. And we're doing a lot of work in Idaho. There's a HPV summit coming up in a few weeks that some of you may be aware of in here in Boise. I'll be speaking there with Chris Johnson, the epidemiologist from our cancer registry, about HPV cancer in Idaho, how it's impacting us, and about the vaccine. You may be aware, they just went down from 3 doses to 2 doses recommendation. And I thought of that when our new president said we should be giving vaccinating children, but with lower doses. I thought, well, President Trump, we're doing that with HPV. We've dropped it from 3 doses to 2 doses. But we can't do that, obviously, for most vaccines. But science is there, and we need to give what will protect. And fortunately, my daughter was too late to benefit. She got her 3 doses, but my son, who just turned 11, will only need 2. Number 7, wash your produce. Wash your produce. And I say this because I am shocked at how many times I see people that don't. And I'm at their house and about to eat dinner, and I'm like, but I do have a caveat to that. I went, before I gave this talk, I went and I rechecked. At least the official position from the FDA is that those bags of pre-washed lettuce and pre-washed produce are fine. You don't need to wash them. I will admit, I still do. But I think what they're concerned about, reading through their materials, is that people, I have friends that will, for example, dump produce into their sink and wash it right in the sink. And they're afraid of people actually contaminating their produce when they're washing it, because their sink might have germs in it from when they were just rinsed that chicken in there. So FDA is actually discouraging people from washing the pre-washed produce. But I think if you know how to do it right and you've got a salad spinner, I think it's still worth doing. However, our outbreaks in this country, produce is the number one cause now, especially leafy vegetables. I think of those, they grow close to the ground. There's lots of little places for germs to hang on to them. But the most deadly outbreaks are still related to meat and dairy. The ones that really cause serious infections, Campylobacter, Salmonella, Listeria, those are usually found in our unpasteurized dairy products or mishandled dairy products and in our undercooked meats or mishandled meats. Number 8, you don't ever know an infectious disease. They keep changing. So when I went through my infectious disease training, I thought, oh, I know everything I need to know about anthrax. It's extremely rare. It's in the soil. And unless you work with cows, you don't really have to worry about anthrax too much, or you're out there tilling the soil. Well, that all changed in 2001, of course, with the white powder incidents, right? Oh, goodness, anthrax comes through the mail now. It really changes. Our state communications center, after the 2001 attacks, which you might remember were out of New Jersey in the east, we had no cases out here, but we took 133 calls related to suspicious powders. So our state communications center handled all these. Sometimes they'd have to call hazmat on the scene, worked closely with hazmat, worked closely with state emergency responders. Our state lab tested, of those all those calls, they tested 29 letters and packages, a mailbox, a dustbuster, a pillbox, a dollar, a steering wheel, some catalogs, and a paper towel. And they were all negative for anthrax. But that is what public health does. There was fear and concern, and we addressed that and helped people feel safe and feel like their concerns are being taken care of. Botulism, we were just talking about this the other day, Elke and I. So botulism, I still think of the dented can when I think of botulism. And yet, most botulism now is not your commercial. Commercial companies have gotten so good at production and safety that it is home canning that is now the major risk for foodborne botulism or home-prepared foods. And the largest botulism outbreak in this country in decades was in Ohio, you may recall, in 2015, a church supper. And it was home canned potato salad made from home canned potatoes. That is our risk now for botulism. It's still rare. I don't want to discourage home canning. I think it's a great thing to do. But that is what we worry about the most. West Nile. West Nile is carried on mosquitoes. Everybody knows that. Well, how did it first come into Idaho? Alligators. And the way those alligators brought it in is they were being brought in as part of a commercial fish operation, and they had some alligators on the side. And
alligators are very susceptible to West Nile, and I did not know this until this happened. Their little eyelids get bitten up by mosquitoes, and that is how alligators get West Nile. And these baby alligators are brought in. Some of them were dying. It turned out it was of West Nile, and somebody was checking out to try to figure out why that was happening and cut themselves and got exposed to West Nile, and that was our first Idaho case from an alligator. So you just never know. That's right. So stay away from those alligators. And lastly, I want to, with those diseases, I'll mention Zika. Zika is the first time we've had a mosquito-borne virus that we know and has now been shown can be transmitted sexually. Kind of unheard of. They're mosquito-borne, but now we know they can be transmitted. And also, of course, the first mosquito-borne virus with great evidence that it can cause birth defects. Hopefully, will be very limited entry into the United States. We've seen now cases in Florida acquired locally and in southern, very, very, very southern Texas, and hopefully that's where it'll stay. Ebola, when I was in infectious disease training, was a remote African disease that I would never have to know much about. Obviously, that all changed. Number 9, we always have to be ready for those outbreaks. Yes, the big public health threats that face us today are not necessarily Ebola or Zika, but as I demonstrated with the anthrax, we need to be there in public health because the public needs it and expects it, that we are assuring them and being able to keep them safe. Number 10, access to health care is not enough for good health. Access to health care is so important. We've heard a lot about it. We're all watching what's happening now with Obamacare and the changes and access to insurance. And we continue, and I know the director's been very, very dedicated to trying to improve access to health care in Idaho. That's extremely important. But we know that good health is more than that. We want to be healthy without needing a lot of health care. And what public health does is working with the private sector to keep people safe, keep people healthy, so hopefully they're not needing as much health care. So I'll conclude by saying that we are trying very hard to maintain our capacity in those areas, and yet we are aware of the new health threats facing Idaho. We have just started to use emergency department data in a new way with all the great new data we have available to us. We have now worked with a district health department up north, and they've been able to send out alerts to people with the cold weather. There were several visits to emergency departments for carbon monoxide exposure, so they were able to send a health alert out to the public, reminding them about the dangers. We've also been involved in the last year and a half with cannabidiol for children with severe seizures. I heard there was going to be a forum on the issues around medical marijuana. Cannabidiol, the program, which was ordered by the governor in 2015, is what's called a compassionate use program. These are children with severe seizures. There's a medication that is being in clinical trials by the FDA but not yet licensed, and the parents are desperate for something. So we've been able to make that available to them working with a local neurologist. We've also expanded our work with healthcare-associated infections, lest you think we don't think about that. I haven't talked about that yet. Healthcare-associated infections are a growing problem, especially highly drug-resistant infections. We now have a full-time person working with some of our partners around the state on that issue. And I attend infection prevention meetings at the two major hospitals, as do many of the district health department staff in their local areas. Suicide. The legislature authorized us a new suicide prevention program, which is brand new, just starting up, but they're already moving forward with improving our suicide hotline access and working on youth suicide, which is a huge problem. And then lastly, I'll mention our prescription drug overdose grant that we just received in September. We are aware that opioids are a huge and growing problem throughout the country, including in Idaho, and we are partnering with the Office of Drug Policy, with the Board of Pharmacy, with the district health departments, and with providers around the state to try to get a handle on that. So I'll conclude with a quote by Franklin Delano Roosevelt that I really like. The success or failure of any government in the final analysis must be measured by the well-being of its citizens. Nothing can be more important to a state than its public health. The state's paramount concern should be the health of its people. So thank you.
All right. Well, thank you. Dr. Hunt, I want to remind our radio listeners that they are listening to a City Club of Boise forum featuring Dr. Christine Hahn. She's Idaho's state epidemiologist and a medical director in the Idaho Department of Health and Welfare's Division of Public Health. I am the unrelated moderator, Greg Hahn. I'm up here because the City Club Forums Committee thought it would be funny to have a bunch of Hahns on stage. And I'm going to keep milking my tiny bit of knowledge about Jon Snow and ask a question that's been in my head since I got dragged to this corner in Soho. He, from what I understand, built a grid, marked on his little map where people were sick, went and interviewed them and found out that the folks who went to this well or this pump had gotten sick, and the ones who didn't, the guys who worked at the brewery who only drank beer, the folks who kind of had their own wells, did not. How different is that from this type of work today?
Thank you, Greg. Yeah, you know, in some ways, it's exactly the same. And that's what I think that's one reason it resonates so strongly with us. Budding epidemiologists are always told this story in their first lecture, I think, and it's because it really is the same. When we have cases that come in, the district epidemiologists immediately start figuring out where these people live, interviewing them one by one. It's what did you eat? You know, what did you, depending on the condition, of course, the questions are different, but it's very, very much the same. Sometimes we have great new data we can use that, of course, Jon Snow did not have access to, but the heart of it is the same.
Right. All right, so we've got a bunch of questions, and thank you for doing that, folks here. And I'm going to start a little bit with some general ones, then we'll talk about some Idaho-specific issues and then maybe some disease-specific issues. This is a slight variation of one it was in my head. In your career, what has been the most exaggerated or blown out of proportion health issue? I was going to ask, what should keep us up at night? But I think I'd rather hear the answer to this question.
Wow, this feels like there's a lot of minefields in that question that I have to carefully think about. Because I think we're sometimes accused of blowing things out of proportion ourselves, and so I have to think, well, did we blow that out of proportion, or did somebody else? You know, I'll say a couple things to that. I think, first of all, hindsight's always 20/20, right? It'd be easy for me now to say, well, Ebola, you know, that didn't really turn into anything. You know, Zika doesn't seem to be doing what the people worried about. But I want to remind everybody that our job is to let people know of possible threats, even if the chances are small. If you told me there's a 1 in 100 chance that Ebola is coming to Idaho, I still want to know that, you know. And yet, 99% chance I'm wrong. As far as things that I think have sometimes made the news, and yet, you know, we look at it like, really? I'll mention one thing right away, bed bugs. Bed bugs were, we got more calls about bed bugs for a while. I'm sure the district health departments had the same thing. We got more calls about that for a while, as if it was a huge public health threat. They're a nuisance, but as to date, they've not been conclusively shown to spread disease of any type. I'm sure that'll happen. I've seen some papers suggesting that maybe. And it reminds me that when I was in Malawi, I spent 3 months in Malawi when I was in my residency, and I had bed bugs, didn't give it a second thought. I would just wake up every morning like, oh, you know, more red spots all over, and what can you do? I had no choice, really, there wasn't much that could be done about it. And so I always had this very Pshaw bed bug approach. And yet I understand why people were concerned. First of all, I certainly wouldn't want them in my home. But that's one thing that I remember being very surprised at how much attention it got and how people thought of it as a public health problem, even though in my mind it was a nuisance and certainly something that people would not want in their home, but not a public health problem.
Right. Kept me from a few hotels that I wanted to stay in that my wife did not allow when we were traveling back.
Yeah, not saying I'd have the same cavalier attitude today that I did when I was 20, but...
This is kind of a nice little follow-up to that, but what is, you know, maybe what out there is an important health issue, and you probably mentioned it in your talk, that we aren't appreciating enough. What could we be paying more attention to?
A couple things I'll say. One is gonorrhea and syphilis. We have large outbreaks in Idaho right now of gonorrhea and syphilis. The district health departments have put out press releases. They're putting out health alerts. We are trying to inform people. But people glaze over, you know, when you say that, because it's like, oh, it's kind of like the TB. Oh, aren't those vanquished? You know, surely we don't, you know, or I'm certainly not personally at risk of that. But we, I think that's a, that's, those problems are something that we wish we knew how to get the public's attention on and solve. We have not been able to solve those problems. And gonorrhea has been much in the news lately in public health circles because it is growing resistant to all the treatments. A few years ago, there were three options. We're down to one option, and there's evidence now that, that there's, it's getting resistant to that last option. So it's a tough one, but that's one that I wish we were able to do better with.
Okay. I knew that was going to be a scary answer. Okay, this is a good one. Probably came from our table here of health experts. We hear a lot about the social determinants of health in the news, like your zip code is a better predictor of health than your genetic code, according to the questionnaire, and I believe that. How do you see public health and the business and the policy communities working together to address these other factors?
Yeah, that's a great question. There's a if I could do slides, I would have shown you guys this pyramid. I couldn't figure out how to make that easy in a talk. But many people believe now that if health is a pyramid, if you will, the base is social determinants of health. That has the widest and broadest impact on the public's health, is social determinants of health. So, and that is things like poverty, you know, education, living in neighborhoods that are safe. And those are the most difficult to change in a way, and yet they're the most important and the most beneficial. I think that there are many of our programs, some of which I haven't had time to talk about, but there are several programs that we have that work very closely already with business partners. There are programs that are, for example, our physical activity program. They work very hard with neighborhoods to try to get more sidewalks, more walkability. I would love to see, you know, continued efforts and growing efforts in with business partners trying to get walkability of the community to be increased. We would love to see more work in other areas as well, other chronic diseases. I know that there's been a lot of work done to try to, for example, smoking laws, of course, have gone a long way. Where you go back and you watch Mad Men when people are smoking in the office, we have come a long way with a lot of those things, but mm-hmm. I'd love to see some of those partnerships continue.
Right. And this is kind of a little bit of a follow-up to that, but maybe, you know, talking about these soft human health issues, I mean, how does a health department, a public health division in the state address some of these things? Like this questioner points out, Utah declared pornography being a concern. We know that workplace, you know, burnout, workplace issues are also something people discuss. What's the role, kind of I guess the state in this case, in playing a role in discussing that?
Yeah, I mean, as I alluded to, I think one of the challenges of public health is it could be everything, right? And so you have to decide what can we do with our resources and where should we focus. And so I feel like we're a state agency, and the people maybe most directly for me is my boss, and then maybe next in my mind is sort of the legislature and what they tell us to do, this new suicide program, for example. We need to follow the direction of the people to tell us where we need to focus. We're more than half of our funding in public at the state public health is federal. So if we can't get funding for something, for example, we can't put a lot of energy into it. So it's what is the will of the people and what can we get funded to do,
right,
really drives us. There are so many other issues that we either don't have the resources or the ability to tap into.
This is another state agency question. What are the role that state agencies play in the protection against bioterrorism threats? This is something that maybe funding is coming on as it relate to the malicious spread of infectious disease.
Yeah, so bioterrorism, I alluded to briefly with anthrax. That's probably been our most visible response. But we do have a preparedness program within our division, and they work very much behind the scenes, but they're so critical. Most recently, they've been working with the Board of Pharmacy to help make sure that there was a pharmacy that Weezer, there was a pharmacy whose roof collapsed from the snow, and they helped set up, kind of ensure that there was an alternate for those folks to go to. So this program works very hard. Bioterrorism, of course, back in 2003, some of you may recall there was a smallpox vaccination campaign. Smallpox was declared eradicated in 1980. So why were we vaccinating against smallpox again? Well, there was concern that it could be used as a bioterrorism agent, and so there was an effort, and people around the state were vaccinated against smallpox. So we stay ready, through our preparedness program, through our state communications center, and through our epidemiologists to prepare to respond to something like that.
Oh, great. We've got a few questions here about kind of some Idaho-specific things. One of them is, what is your thoughts on public health, the role of public health related to Alzheimer's disease in Idaho?
Sarah Taves, was that your question? Okay. 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 All right. Yeah. No, that's a great question. And Alzheimer's is clearly a growing problem. The aging of our population is clearly important and is going to impact the directions we need to go. We do have, of course, our Division of Behavioral Health as well, that also has an important role to play in that. Mental health, including Alzheimer's, including suicide, including prescription drug overdose. I think that whole area of improving our as a society, we've been somewhat blind to mental health, including issues around aging, and I think we're realizing we have a growing role in that, but I think it's still getting shaped.
Right. All right, so these are some Idaho, your boss is sitting over here on the table, so I'll preface these questions with letting the radio audience know that. All right, Idaho is a gun-loving state, this person says. How does public health address, or what role does public health play in reducing gun-related injuries?
Yeah, I thought I might get asked that question, actually. So some of you may be aware, there's a painful history, if you will, between public health and gun injuries. And the short version is that there were studies done, funded by CDC, looking at gun injuries that led eventually to defunding of some of the CDC's programs because there was Congress did not want to continue to fund that. I'll put it that way. So there is a very very difficult history there in Idaho, and I looked at the data. Our gun injuries are far greater for suicide than they are for homicide. And accidental injury and death is actually more common than homicide. So I feel like in our state, where our new suicide program, part of that I know is going to include safe storage messaging, you know, safe handling, education for youth and everybody. And I think we can do a lot of ground through our suicide program, and that is a great place for us to start.
All right. We're going to keep going down the rabbit hole of Idaho issues here. You talked about vaccines for a while, but I got lots of questions on them. And I think if you could talk a little bit about what the trend looks like in Idaho, and then what you think the new administration is going to how that might affect things.
Right. So the trend is
so much easier to ask the questions than to answer.
Yeah.
As somebody who has to do both occasionally.
The trend is great. We actually have, for a long time, we were 49th or 50th in the nation. Some of you may remember that for childhood immunization. We have now improved. Really, in 2010, working with the legislature, a lot of good changes were made. In 2011, we tightened up some of our methods for purchasing vaccine. We improved our registry. We created an immunization policy commission. And we required for the first time 7th graders to have certain adolescent immunizations, specifically, the meningitis vaccine and then a tetanus and pertussis vaccine. Our rates have steadily improved since then. And we're now, right now, kind of middle of the pack. There's a little room for improvement, but our immunization rates have really improved in the last several years. I don't know how the new administration is going to affect things. I've heard two messages, and they're kind of in conflict, so I'm kind of waiting to see what happens. One is that my understanding is the new administration is supportive of public health and supportive of immunizations. That's great. On the other hand, some of you may have heard last week the announcement that Bobby Kennedy Jr. was going to be chairing a new commission on vaccine safety. And for those of you that follow Bobby Kennedy Jr., as I do, He is a strong, and my sister used to work for him, actually, when he worked in environmental health. She was an environmental lawyer. And he went from environmental issues like safe water, mercury in waters and all that. He made the leap into vaccines and is now a strong anti-vaccine agenda. So I was very discouraged to hear about that, but then the administration said, no, we really didn't offer him that. So we're all kind of waiting, I guess, is the best way to say that. So I'm not quite sure what's going to happen. I do think that public health and our messages will be able to continue to give them.
All right. This is a good question, too, about something that we hear talk a lot about at the State House. It hasn't been resolved yet. What are the public health consequences of what they call the gap, 78,000 Idahoans who are not insured? you know, I know they had an interim committee. This person asked, has the state studied the costs associated with it, the deaths that that might cause? How are the costs distributed? What is the kind of your approach as a public health leader with that population?
Right. Another very, very challenging question, and I know that, again, I'm going to acknowledge the director has spent so much energy trying to solve this issue, and we're still hopeful with this legislative session maybe there will be some progress. I think what we know is that although, as I mentioned earlier, health care is not a guarantee of good health, it certainly makes it possible, and that without health care, people are not as healthy. So we know there are consequences to their health and to the public's health. Also, though, as the director is fond of saying, we're going to pay for this care one way or the other. These people do show up in our emergency departments. They do eventually get the care they need. And wouldn't we much rather have a healthier population that's getting good preventive care than needing treatment after they've got some terrible outcomes or bad outcomes? So I'm hopeful. I know there are several solutions that have already been that are potentially being put forward this session. I don't know if any of them will come to pass, but I think that the work of the people that have been fighting for this will go on, and I know that eventually we will solve this problem.
All right, now this last one. And this is going to make the other ones look like a walk in the park. Sorry about that. Can you address the child deaths in the findings of the Idaho Child Fatality Review Team? Some of them were classified as preventable, but parents did not seek medical treatment due to religious beliefs. Would you support, and you don't have to answer this, these are tough ones to put you on the spot, but removing the religious exemptions to Idaho Code? Maybe how do you approach this from a public health perspective?
Yeah. Wow, I want to know who with that
somebody,
question.
Yeah, this person should be on your list. I'm sure it wasn't
you. That's right. Yeah. A couple things. First of all, until last year, I was a member of the Child Mortality Review Team, so I'm very familiar with the individual cases, and they are heartbreaking. They're heartbreaking because these are children that from the background of a physician and a public health person, one can only conclude that these deaths could have been prevented, and the team did conclude that in several of these deaths. I just spoke earlier about with immunization, us trying to respect the rights of parents to make decisions, and yet it's very hard to have that position with these outcomes. I personally, and speaking as a private citizen, I would like to see some changes made where medical providers could override in certain cases that right. That's my personal decision. I cannot, of course, speak for the department or how things will go. I do hope we see some movement in that direction. It's just too difficult and painful to see these deaths, and when medical intervention could have saved a life, it's very hard to say don't intervene.
All right. You made it through the grilly part. We have a few easier ones here. Maybe we do. This is a good one for the North End types that I see a lot. Talk about the threat of raw milk consumption.
Yeah. All right. Okay, so this is another one. Us public health types freak out about raw milk because we do. So until a few years ago, there was no way to legally sell raw milk in Idaho. Now there is. There are licensed raw milk dairies in Idaho. And they are licensed through Department of Agriculture, and those they undergo some inspection and some safety maneuvers. I see that, speaking of the North End, when I go to the co-op, I see the raw milk products there. I personally choose not to drink them, but I feel like there is a process in place. People choosing to drink that, it's their own. It's like some. I support people's right to legally smoke cigarettes as long as it's legal. I can't tell people that I can tell people I don't think they should smoke, but I support people's legal rights under the law to drink it. I don't think they should give it to their children. I think it's too high risk, and we've seen some terrible cases in the last few years of people drinking raw milk, usually not through these licensed dairies, but through other cow shares or other programs. We've seen children get very, very sick, and we have a pregnant woman that lost her baby. She did not realize it was raw milk. She was given raw milk. You see outcomes like that, and you think, I really think the message should be, certainly, if you choose to do this, that's fine. I don't think it should be given to children.
Mm-hmm. This one I could have asked myself, and I bet everybody in here, because we've heard this forever, and it doesn't make any sense unless you know what you're talking about. Why are dented cans a botulism risk?
Yeah, well, the reason, the dent itself is not a problem. It's if it's dented enough to let air in. So when in the canning process, the idea is to not let air in there because air promotes spoilage. So if you dent, and I'll look at a can sometimes and go, it's on sale. It's slightly dented. And in my opinion, it's not dented enough to have, you know, compromise the integrity of the can. I will occasionally purchase that product. But if I think it's really dented, really, really dented, I won't buy it. So the key is the air, letting the air in.
All right. That does make sense. I knew it wasn't just bruised and
misreacted to it, right?
I guess. I don't know. I never really thought about it. I probably just ate it anyway. I'm glad. I should point out, I'm glad that last week is when I went with my Basque wife's family to make our own sausage, and so I hung my sausage in the guest bedroom last week, and then I packaged it up, and I'm going to eat it, and I'm glad I did all that before this. And I'll let you know how that goes if I'm here next year. You're all welcome for dinner if you're willing to do it. We have a couple questions on the flu shot. This question is why are flu cases up? Does it have something to do with the vaccine effectiveness? And somebody who got terribly sick last time they had it, now they don't. Is that a normal reaction? Should they give another shot? They didn't ask that, but I'm going to throw that
you
in.
You are, okay. All right. Yeah, a couple things. First of all, one thing I find interesting is when the dust settles and all is said and done, we look back and we decide whether we thought it was a bad flu season. But we always get asked early in the season, is it a bad flu season? We're like, it's too soon to tell. So remember, what the media and the public, through the media, sometimes perceives as a bad flu season is if it's early. So like if flu hits in October, oh my God, people are like, whoa, it's here early, and people rush out and get their shot. We actually kind of like it when it's early because it kind of people get motivated and they go get their shots. The other thing is if it hits all at once. And one thing I've noticed this year is it seemed like there was no flu. Oh, it's everywhere. And ultimately, at the end of the year, when we look back and we look at the number of deaths and we look at the number of people hospitalized, we might say, oh, the numbers are about the same as another year. But because it sometimes kind of seems to explode out of nowhere, the perception can be that it's a bad season. We are just in the middle of that where it seemed, I was just at St. Luke's this morning. I mentioned I participate in their infection prevention committee, and they said, wow, we are really seeing a lot of flu right now. They've really seen an uptick. I know St. Al's, I think, put out a press release yesterday. I heard it on the radio. So I think the hospitals are trying to tell us they're starting to see a lot of flu. I don't think that has anything to do with the effectiveness of the flu vaccine, because I don't think not enough of us are immunized to know how much that would protect us. As you may know, there's this concept of herd immunity, which is a little shadowy, but really says that to really prevent any disease from spreading, we need to have a lot higher rates. Maybe 75, 80, 90% of people need to be immunized in most circumstances to really prevent spread throughout a community. So we are nowhere near that with flu. So the fact that it's exploding like this doesn't say anything about the flu shot. We do know it seems to be a good match to the virus this year, so we expect that when the dust settles and we look back at the data, it appears that the flu shot is going to have worked really well this year, but it's too soon to say. We can't say that yet.
All right.
And then there was that, somebody getting sick. Yeah, a couple of things. First of all, flu shots, I always get a sore arm from it, but I understand some people feel worse than that after they get their flu shot. It's a personal decision. If you're under 50, I always love the intranasal one for people that just don't do well with a shot. My kids get that every year. And they do very, very well with that. Sometimes what can happen, especially if you wait, is you get your flu shot, and then the next day you come down with the real flu, and that flu shot isn't going to protect you for a couple weeks while your antibodies are building up. So it's possible this person asking the question got their flu shot and then actually just got the flu coincidentally a few days later. A lot of, especially the people that kind of wait till flu hits, that is a risk.
Right. All right. Did such a great job on all the tough ones. We're going to have to call it quits, but I want to have everybody give Dr. Christine Hahn a round of applause. I really appreciate the time. As we always do here at the City Club, this grand prize of a City Club mug will be presented to her. Thank you very much for sharing your wisdom with us today.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the City Club of Boise, a nonpartisan forum discussing important issues of the day in a civil manner. Find on-demand audio of this and other forums, learn about becoming a member, and see a schedule of upcoming events at cityclubofboise.org. Connect on Facebook and Twitter by searching for City Club of Boise.